content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. And underwriting our podcast for, 15 years? They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to revisit the November 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. Our theme this month has been Pie Towns. And then it also has sub-themes, 11 places to get the sweetest slices of the pie, gives you a whole bunch of them, plus cabins and cottages, which we were reading about last time. And let's continue on that theme this week with the fishing camps of Core Bank. Pretty picture here. Sunset above a cottage, obviously on the beach with all the seagrass and the sand here in the foreground. It says there are no paved roads around the fishing camps of Core Banks. No electricity, no grocery stores or bars. The spare cottages here provide only tranquility. Some folks arrive alone for weekends of angling and solitude. Others bring families and pets for a relaxing vacation at the very edge of the continent. Core Banks, the long, slender, least inhabited of North Carolina's barrier islands, lies east of the colonial seaport town of Beaufort. The first time Ann and I went to stay in one of the two fishing encampments out on those banks, each of our 8-year-old twins, Hunter and Susanna, brought along a friend, and our daughter Carrie was 10 months old. Late that Friday afternoon, we embarked on the car and passenger ferry Green Grass from Morris Marina on the north side of the Atlantic. A light rain picked up quickly and became driving, and the fog sat down and soon enshrouded Core Sound. We all crowded into the cabin with Captain Glenn Lewis while he piloted us slowly forward through the cloud. Half an hour later, he backed off on the throttle and, as if he had been able to see right through the thick fog the whole time, eased us into a channel marked by white PVC pipes and brought us safely up to the Long Point Morris Marina Cabin Camp's landing. In less than 10 minutes, we had rolled Ann's father's GMC Jimmy truck, loaded with groceries and gear, off of the green grass and on down to the lake to the small tar paper cabin number 13, its screens encrusted with salt. There the seven of us would stay safe and snug until Sunday. Daughter Susanna had everything planned and ordered out in quarter-hour units. A board game for 15 minutes, drawing for another 15, ghost stories after that, and so on. But the reality of the children's delicious moments in this way-down-home spot was just as casual as was the shanty itself. Later, the kids settled down by candlelight. We read them John Harden's account of the 1921 Diamond Shoals shipwreck of the 5-masted Carol A. Deering, all sails set. Captain and crew disappeared forever. And then, the next morning, in the spirit of coastal exploration and adventure, Carrie took her first steps. Only two of them, mind, but still, it happened in cabin number 13. 2 years later, our family clamored for a return. So on a blue sky day in late July, we gathered for another Core Banks adventure, this time at Davis, a few miles down the Sound from Atlantic. There we boarded our own craft, a 17-foot Boston whaler. We were six this time, our guest being 12-year-old Carolyn Parsons, down from Brooklyn, all headed for the Alger Willis camps of South Core Banks at Great Island Bay. Before we took in lines, I went aboard the ferryboat Captain Alger to seek the route along the camps, into the camps, and about 3 miles away, a bearded tattooed mate told me, go in at a pole with a yellow sign with a bicycle on it, and follow the ferry channel, and it'll take you right in. Once there, we docked and entered our shanty. Carrie, then three, sensing and seeing rusticity before her, walls open down to the framing, asked excitedly, Mama, is this all tore up? Well, not quite, but certain evidence of a relaxed approach to house churning. Soon came a flashlight tag for the children, and after supper we all went out of the cabin one more time before bed down to the nighttime shore, the distant lookout light beaming our way every so often. There, beyond the brilliant diamond sky and the Milky Way, we all gazed up and marveled at the Delta Aquarids, shooting stars falling over us by the score. Our literature is filled with intriguingly remote shelters, like Henry David Thoreau's self-made 10-by-15 cabin at Walden Pond, Annie Dillard's house clamped to the side of Tinker Creek, Horace Kephart's Back of Beyond log and plank cabin up Hazel Creek in the Smokies, Captain Moses Grandy's little hut on the shore of Lake Drummond, and Henry Beston's 1920 beach cottage forecastle, his literal outermost house in the Cape Cod Dunes. In many of us, at some time or another, there arises the desire to be off and away, in the last house down the lane, or out on the point, or in the tent in deep woods, a little bit farther apart from the rest, for the calm and quiet, if nothing else, or for real recovery and healing, or even just for the outright romance of it. Venturing either just a little way or many miles from the tiny encampments of South Core and North Core, each of the paired barriers being about 20 miles long, gains one an even rarer level of solitude than the camps themselves, as well as vistas into infinity. Looking away to where the lines of surf and sand converge, I can hear Shakespeare's Prospero speaking to me of such stuff as dreams are made on, and I'm grateful for this paradise of fair winds, tight lines, and a few good days and nights in a cottage by the sea. Most days out here from early spring to mid-autumn are golden and bright, sparkling sunlight reflecting off the many waters beneath a great vaulted blue sky. Though noisily brooding black, purple thunderstorms will roll through, too, so one always must keep a weather eye. Heavier winds can push the surf over the frontal dunes or even through them, as Hurricane Dorian did in early September 2019, creating 54 inlets through the North Core banks, including one that lay waves of ruin upon the Long Point cabins, closing them for at least the following 2 years. In a sense, an acute awareness of oceanic dynamics is what makes our being out in these little houses so deep and rich in the first place, tying us in ways to the hidden world of mullet camps, those late 1800s fishermen's seashore shelters of brush and thatch that historian David Selesky sings of so well, and also to the rugged coastal experience of the 19th century diamond city folk, the Care Bakers who lived on the Shackleford Banks just west of Cape Lookout, not so very far south of two present-day Core Banks fish camps. We see what they saw, high, piling clouds in an endless sky, rolling breakers of an endless sea, sun setting brilliantly over the sound, and we are not only observing the grand rotations. Out in this elemental here, we are part of them. Our family left the Alger Willis camp in the Whaler on another blue sky day, perfect for an afternoon's boat ride back into Beaufort. Young Brooklynite Carolyn Parsons rode up in the bow with our son Hunter, at one point proclaiming to the heavens with great purpose and joyful noise, when I'm older, I'm coming back to walk the whole way from the camps down to Lookout Light. Carolyn may not have done that quite yet, and nowadays the small lodging stand where we stayed more than a quarter century ago are better made and tighter against the wind and rain. They're rustic wooden rectangles, mostly, still without refrigerators, but with rockers on porches facing out to glory. They're little buildings, well, only 100 square feet in size, yet a slightly larger than the tar paper cabins that stood out here in those fisher folks' redoubts for decades. But the old yearning possibility is still open to our Brooklyn friend, and indeed to all of us, as is the wide-open Corbanks locale of these small outermost houses upon what the environmental writer Rachel Carson called a strange and beautiful place at the very edge of the sea. A little sidebar here says, if you go, please check with nps.gov/calo, that's calo.planyourvisit/lodging.htm. Got that? I'm not even going to bother to give you the next one because it's just as long and complicated. Okay, then, on to a peaceful yet easy village. A country doctor created an idyllic ghost town of 19th century log cabins in rural Catawba County. 5 decades later, his granddaughter continues to nurture this living museum of pioneer life for new generations. Written by Gavin Edwards. After she visits the working grist mill equipped with 2-ton stones, and after she stops by the log cabins stuffed with looms, but before she heads over to the antique stockade, Rebecca Hart explains why the pioneer era is her favorite piece in history. People had to find everything on their own, she says. When something broke, they couldn't just throw it away. They had to be kind to each other. At this point, it becomes clear that although she's been discussing the history of 19th century American settlers, she's also talking about the story of her own family. Rebecca, a 31-year-old with honey brown hair tied back in a ponytail, is the executive director of the Hart Square Foundation. Wearing a plaid shirt and denim pants, she handles everything from fundraising for a fancy new 16,000-square-foot education center to scrubbing floors of that very same center. Her grandfather, Bob Hart, began building Hart Square Village in the early 70s on a 200-acre tract of land in Catawba County. Today, 103 historic structures dating from 1760 to 1880 dot the landscape. Workshops, corn cribs, a doctor's office, a schoolhouse, an 18th century smokehouse, a 19th century pigsty, and dozens of log cabins, all rescued from the backwoods and remote crannies of North Carolina. The new education center has air conditioning, a modern roof, and ADA-compliant fixtures. But it's not a museum filled with electronic kiosks and flashy exhibits. At Hart Square Village, the governing philosophy is that you will learn about the past by touching it. One of Barb Hart's precepts for the village was that nothing would be kept behind glass or on a velvet rope. Every fork and spool of thread in the cabins was a living piece of history that could be held. But on the flip side of this approach was that the village was open to the public only once a year for a festival in October. Every year you would check to see what the new cabins were there, says Jamie Beatty, who's been attending the festival since they began in 1986. It was like a normal town that would grow when new people moved in. Rebecca Hart has been working to honor the traditions of her grandfather while making the idyllic village she created more accessible than Brigadoon. The October Festival, full of historic demonstrations, now shares the calendar with the Summer Sunflower Festival and Spring Easter Egg Hunt. While the village has been available for school field trips for years, only in the summer of 2021 did it begin opening on weekdays, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., to members who pay an annual fee so they can roam its trails, getting lost amid the dusty footprints of the past. Bob relocated his first cabin to the spot in the rolling hills, roughly 10 miles south of Hickory, in 1973. At the time, he was so ignorant of how to move a cabin that he didn't realize he should also bring the original floor and the stones it rested on. Then he decided that a log cabin needed a barn to go with it, and then another cabin, and then there was no stopping him. He kept working on the village until his death in March 2020. A medical doctor by profession, Bob was at his happiest in a simulation of a world without MRIs or penicillin. When he wasn't transporting and reassembling old log cabins, he was flying around the state in a Cherokee 6 airplane looking for cabins from the air. All but one of the buildings at Hart Square Village came from within a 25-mile radius. Bob and his wife, Becky, also searched for antique items of everyday pioneer life. Becky would then use them to furnish the cabins, making the structures feel as if their occupants had just stepped out for a few minutes. The couple ultimately placed more than 8,000 pieces throughout the village. Becky learned to accept Bob's obsession with the project, which she did with good humor, except for the time when he dispatched a 6-foot snake that had feasted on a nest full of duck eggs, a serpent in the garden of history. He killed the snake by swinging it around and whacking it against a tree. The technique worked, but it also ejected half-digested eggs from the snake's gullet all over Becky. "She didn't speak to me for about a week," Bob later reported. Bob and Becky particularly treasured the times when they could consult with living family members about the history of the cabins. The Norwood House was donated to the village when Bob visited its owner, Essie Norwood, in the hospital. Then in her 90s, she told him a story from when she was a little girl. At dinner time, she would drop fragments of food through the cracks between the floorboards, feeding the chickens that roamed under the house. So not only was the house reconstructed with those cracks, but Bob also installed some fake chickens underneath. Norwood didn't think she would live to see the house rebuilt, but before she died in 1984, she saw her childhood home standing among its cousins and started to cry. As Bob reached his 70s, the family worried about him still doing construction work, sometimes on ladders without a helper. Finally, he told them, "I want to die out here. Why are you bothering me about it?" Rebecca says her grandfather regretted not growing up on a log cabin himself. He used to say that when he died, he hoped heaven had cabins. Like a colonial history Pied Piper, Bob Hart inspired dozens of people to donate their time and talents to Hart Square Village. It helped that people liked spending time in his version of the past. With the blood and privations faded away, what remains here are monuments to ingenuity and survival and family traditions. Walking around the village, getting red clay in your boots, it's easy to drift into contemplation, feeling as if you're stepping into the footprints of your ancestors. A sense of peace comes over me, Jamie Beattie says of her visits. It's like you can breathe better. People don't get mean here, Rebecca observes. There aren't a lot of peaceful places in the world. Hart Square Village is an oasis, one built by generations of human hands. The village contains the handiwork of hundreds of North Carolina families. Before these buildings were history, they were homes, some of them as recently as the 1970s. Rebecca passes by the Null Hart Zolge House, which is both the oldest cabin in the village, built in 1763, and one of the more recently relocated in 2010. She says that Rick Hartzog and his sister Susan Stewart, who donated their family's house, show up every year for the annual festival. Dressed in old-fashioned clothes, they sit on the porch, greeting visitors, telling stories, reenacting the lives of their own grandparents. Walking through the village that her grandfather built, Rebecca isn't wearing his clothes, but she's continuing his life's work. "We had this conversation one time at dinner," she remembers. "He said the log cabin was the most American building that exists." She smiles, standing in the terrain where her family's history intersects with that of the nation, and then says quietly, "I think it's true." Hart Square Village is on Hope Road in Vail, North Carolina. HartSquare.com. One S in the middle. Hart Square. And now, The Bungalow by Shallow Bag Bay. A few things have changed in Manteo since 1920. When a boat builder constructed his house piece by piece using a Sears kit. Croatan Cottage now welcomes guests to recall a simpler time when plans for a dream home came from a catalog. Written by Marimar McNaughton. The ocean churns as small craft advisory warnings shade the coastline with a slender band of lavender. The sea change and the wind shift are palatable, especially when a clammy fog settles over North Carolina Highway 12 en route to Roanoke Island and downtown Manteo, where one might never know a gale is blowing. For in the heart of this walk-around kind of waterfront town, life strolls on no matter the weather. An easterly turn off U.S. Highway 64 heads toward the banks of Shallow Bag Bay. Traveling north, Fernando Street provides a quaint gateway, winding around late 19th century Queen Anne-style homes and early 20th century bungalows, setting the mood. Glide past a historic boatyard and onto Queen Elizabeth Avenue. Beyond the bustling waterfront marketplace peppered with gourmet cafes and art boutiques, and beneath a leafy canopy, and it comes into view, Croatan Cottage, the historic Clyde and Carola Hassel House, a welcoming haven at Journey's End. As kids, we always called it the Pumpkin House, says John Wilson, a Manteo and Chapel Hill-based architect who was reared on this island and played on these tree-lined streets as a boy. Now he and Bill Parker, both pioneers of preservation, own the rental cottage on Croatan Avenue. This is one wonderful house, Wilson says. We both fell in love with that house. Clyde and Carola Hassel have no children, so the house's story is told by Wilson, who explains that the Hassels ordered their home from the Sears Roebuck Company Modern Homes Catalog. Clyde Hassel, a small craft boat builder, raised the house on site with his helpers. Dare County records state that the home was built in 1929, but Wilson thinks it was earlier. As for evidence of its Prohibition-era origins, apparently Hassel made at least one modification to the kit plans, which Wilson and Parker discovered in the stairwell, a hiding place large enough to stow a jug of the local moonshine, known as East Lake Dew. The Hassel lived in the home in the early 1970s. At midlife, like many other Roanoke Islanders during the 1940s, the couple likely rented rooms to summer visitors. A second owner contracted kitchen and bath upfits before Wilson and Parker became the third owners in 2011. To say that the Hassels started a bungalow movement might be an overstatement, yet several more significant examples are sprinkled throughout the town. Wilson believes that the bungalow at 505 Croatan Avenue is the only kit home in Manteo, though at least one other historic property, the Theodore S. Meekins House, was inspired by Sears' home catalog cover. Wilson would know his great-grandfather built the house in question. It seems that Sears sold 70,000 kit homes between 1908 and 1940, though paper records to substantiate this claim were not kept by the corporation's stewards. The Vellonia, the model chosen by Clyde and Carola Hassel, was offered in the catalog from 1921 through 1940 and retailed for $1,979 around the time of the Hassel's purchase. Of the three grades of pre-cut houses sold by Sears, the Vellonia was among the finest, part of the company's honor-built line. The lumber was thicker. After it was cut and planed in Illinois, it was transported by rail to Norfolk and sent to Elizabeth City. From there, it was shipped by boat down the Pasquotank River to Albemarle Sound and into Roanoke Sound, then Shallow Bag Bay and Doe's Creek, where it was assembled. If you're fortunate enough to sleep here, you'll be welcomed by the subtle touches of manager D. Evans. For each Airbnb or Vrbo guest, she adjusts the amber glow of the arts and crafts sconces. The heavy timber door swings open easily at the touch of a latch. In the parlor where Wilson and Parker appointed the interior with period and reproduction set pieces inspired by the California arts and crafts movement, while honoring the original Sears Roebuck & Company's 1930-ish color palette. The decor is decidedly masculine, a reflection of the Hassels. Not so much, yet very eclectic and true to the form. Dark chocolate-colored ceiling molds and picture rails frame original chandeliers and wall sconces. Deep-silled windows are outlined in glossy white, as are a pair of bent wood-barreled arches leading to lower and upper-level bedroom chambers. The stark contrast is heightened by stained baseboards and authentic two-panel wood doors with crystal knobs, plus celadon green, creamy okra, and khaki-gray three-quarter-inch beadboard walls, bookmatched to the kit's original tints discovered on the property. Every can of paint was in the old man's boathouse, Wilson says. Oak floors are grounded with woven wool rugs in vintage Art Deco angles and Art Nouveau florals, themselves anchored by Mission-style armchairs and Tiffany table lamps. Croydon Cottage's front porch offers an enticing rock back in time. Above, a steep single-gabled roofline belies the second story, save for Clue, the gabled dormer that tells all. The engaged porch is held in place with the stocky brick-and-mortar pilings and cut of craftsman columns. Exposed rafters are yet another recurring craftsman-style tradition, so is the rustic, unwashed fencing that harkens back to a time when livestock had to be kept out of the front gardens. Picture Manteo 100 years ago, a once-thriving harbor anchored by boat-building, ice-cutting and storing, and fish-packing. A public wharf welcomed fishermen and farmers into port to trade. Between 1900 and 1910, Manteo's population spiked from 312 to 1,000, most likely due to the storm of 1899 and other devastating hurricanes that hit the barrier island villages to the south. In their wake, a migration of sorts began. The first Outer Bank villagers' houses arrived by barge, filling available lots between Victorian-era and coastal farmhouse-style dwellings. Likewise, into this white picket neighborhood of year-round islanders where front porches line the sidewalks and painted white scrollwork turned and chamfered posts and decorative brackets were the island standard, the pumpkin house arrived. In the fall follow the scent of Russian oil, cloyingly sweet. In the spring, the heady notes of star jasmine and drooping wisteria beckon. A spritz of citrus from summer mimosa, where the mockingbird makes its nest, is the harbinger of summer. Songbird melodies and weather forecasts aside, a trip to Croydon Village awaits, with or without vintage clothes to match. Croydon Village is at 505 Croydon Avenue, Manteo. Telephone 252-473-5511. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Our Estate Magazine. I certainly hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our Estate Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. You can reach them at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.